Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 78 of Season 7 of Movie Room Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Richard Kirkham, the host of the Lambcast, the shepherd of the lamb, the owner of Kirkham Movie A Day. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
Hey, happy hump day to you, Movie Rob, and to all of your listeners.
Thank you. All right, so minute 78 begins with Jerry explaining the route and ends with John giving Zeus instructions. So we left things off yesterday with John almost giving a beautician turned truck driver a heart attack. And, then Jerry started explaining what this whole idea is of this aqueduct. And, he started saying yesterday, see, goes from here all. And then today he finishes his sentence, the way up to the Catskill Mountains. So are you familiar with the Catskills?
Only from the notion that they are a resort area that people in New York frequented in the old days, that they had, summer camps there for kids, and they had times when the adults would also spend their vacations in the Catskills, and a lot of entertainers, comedians, vaudeville performers worked in the Catskills. But other than that, I don't know anything about it.
Do you know the nickname of the Catskills? Area because of the vaudeville and
I don't think I do.
And the comedians and stuff. It was known as the Borscht Belt.
Oh yes, I have heard that term.
So first of all, the Catskills was named by early Dutch settlers, and the area was used for making movies and works of art, paintings and stuff like that. Because it became a favorite destination of vacationers from New York City. And there are a lot of stand-up comedians that would go and work there, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, even later, to hone their craft. And, for instance, Woodstock is one of the towns that's around there. Anyone who knows, about what happened at Woodstock, that actually happened in the Catskills, which is interesting because people don't usually make that type of association. So it was nicknamed the Borscht Belt, because it became a major vacation destination for Jewish New Yorkers. And at the peak of its popularity, there were more than 500 resorts and hotels that were operating around that area. Most people most people don't go there as much as they did back in the old days, I guess you can say. But it was like people like Milton Berle and what's his name? The Henny Youngman, exactly. Those are some of the people that are known for being part of the whole area of the Borscht Belt. I mean, Borscht Belt is also known as the Yiddish Alps because of the fact that there were so many Jews that would go there. Between the 20s and the 60s, and in the 50s, people stopped. Less people were going, and then by the 70s, most of them had been were closed down. But there were still some of them that stayed open through the 90s. But as of today, there isn't as many places that people still go to in that area. I mean, it was known as the Borscht Belt as a connection to the whole idea of the Bible Belt and the Rust Belt and things like that, the different areas of the, of the country. And I mentioned before, there you go. And the I mentioned it's also known as the Yiddish Alps. That was actually coined by Larry King. You know, he's the one who called it that. You know, to sort of you know, make fun of the whole thing. Now, I remember as a kid, we used to go there just about every summer. You know, my parents had friends who owned a hotel there, and we would go there you know, a few times a year. And you know, every summer there were places that we went. Also, I even had a sister that worked there for one summer, stuff like that. I also remember going to there was a hotel known as Grossinger's that I remember going to. I don't know much about it. I mean, I was a kid, so I don't really remember the whole thing.
Familiar name, by the way, Grossinger's. I think that's probably one of the preeminent hotels in the Borscht Belt.
Yeah, could be. But I actually, with the Grossinger's actually closed in 1986. So I guess I was there before then. For some reason, I think I went there for Thanksgiving once, but I don't know.
Well, for people who aren't familiar with the Catskills and that whole venue, a couple of movies that and TV shows that might give you some insight. Dirty Dancing is set in the Catskills, and there's a good example of how families might vacation there in the area. And The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is a TV series that has several sections where the Catskills are featured, and so you can get a sense of what it was like at that time.
Right. Yeah, I have a list of a whole bunch of comedians that got their start up in these resorts. So you have Woody Allen, Milton Berle, Mel Brooks, Lenny Bruce, George Burns, Red Button, Sid Caesar, Rodney Dangerfield, Phyllis Diller, Estelle Getty, Checky Green, Buddy Hackett, Danny Kaye, Alan King, Robert Klein, Jerry Lewis, Jackie Mason, Carl Reiner, Don Rickles, Joan Rivers, Jonathan Winters, and Henny Youngman. So yeah. So there's a lot to be said for the Borscht Belt, which is no longer around, I guess. So Jerry continues, he explains this up in the Catskill Mountains, and then John goes, "What does?" He goes, "That, the water pipe." And he points to, you know, this huge pipe, you know, which it's amazing to me that this, you know, that they would make these pipes so huge that you can drive trucks through them. You know, I wouldn't even think of that type of thing, you know, in the first place. Did you notice that Zeus is following in the Mercedes or the BMW behind him?
I did see that right at the beginning of this scene. Yes. John is still hanging off the side of the truck. So that's like right. we discussed in an earlier episode, they can't have been going too far because he doesn't even get in the cab of the vehicle to go to the construction site, which makes sense because that's right around where the other dump trucks disappeared. And it was almost sure. immediately that they were gone. So they must right. have been close. That makes sense.
That's right. It's true. And then Jerry goes, the water pipe goes for about 60 miles. And then John jumps off the truck, runs around the truck, pulls out his badge, walks over to a group of men that are there, including, and he goes, "Hey, you the foreman?" He goes, "Yeah." So the guy who plays, the actor who plays the foreman, okay, his name is John Doman. And what's really interesting about him is, so he was born on the 9th of January, 1945. He has 113 IMDb credits. And he only started acting at the age of 46 with his first major role at the age of 48. So, you know, if he was born in 45, that means that this is not long after he just got his first big break. You know, again, he has a very small part here. But, you know, the idea that someone is going to change their career at that late stage in life, you know, and get a part in a Die Hard movie. There you go. That works. So he responds, "Yeah, I'm the foreman." He goes, "NYPD, you have any like empty, do you have any like extra dump trucks coming through here in the last couple of minutes?" And he goes, "I'm going to write those f-ing clowns up. They better start paying attention to work orders or we're going to kick some butt." Who are you talking about? The dozen idiots who tore us up the tube. We're not loading up there anymore. We're loading up here. And he points to the different tubes at the whole thing. And then John makes a very strange comment. He goes, so much for bridges and helicopters. Okay, which is a callback to something beforehand. You know, I think we talked about it 2 weeks ago, where John basically told Cobb that they need more cops to watch the bridges and have helicopters go around. You know, so it's, and
wasn't there a scene that got cut also that where they talked about deploying? He says, I can give you 5 men or 10 men for each of these things. And suddenly it becomes superfluous.
That's right. Correct. But they left it in here. And then, I mean, first of all, you got to give so much credit to Simon and his plan, you know, to say, okay, we're going to have 14 dump trucks and we're going to be able to go through here. And no one's going to stop us. You know, no one's even going to think that there's a problem here. You know, the foreman just complains that these trucks came without the proper paperwork. That was it. But he still let them through. So it's not as if there's any type of repercussions, I guess you can say, for them doing that. So it's like, okay, do whatever you want. So Simon's got a good plan. But I love the visual, you know, where you have the foreman pointing to the two different tunnels. You know, saying that we're working here and not working there and stuff like that.
Yeah. So we get a little bit of sense of the environment, the layout. And we understand that there are different directions that the tunnels go. And he needs to make sure that he gets the right one.
That's right. And at this point, you know, and John is very friendly with the foreman. He shakes his hand and stuff like that. So, it works well. And then John says, you got a map that shows me where this tunnel goes, which you would think that obviously he's going to have a map. I mean, this is a foreman and they're on a big job here. He's got to have some plans. And then he continues explaining and goes, we run pretty much up the sawmill till you get up to the cofferdam. From there on, we've already brought the water down from the reservoir. And then John says, anybody get in or out of there? Yeah, there's a vent shaft every 2 miles. No, I mean with a truck. Just at the cofferdam. You can get a truck in there. You can get there on the surface. Just follow the Sawmill River Parkway up there. It's about 20 miles. So, again, they give us a lot of information here that we're not theoretically supposed to – we don't need to understand, but it's helpful for later with the way that they explain – the whole thing about going on the Sawmill River Parkway and the cofferdam. So, you know, I thought that the cofferdam was a place. Do you know what a cofferdam is?
No.
So it's, you know, I thought like it's the you have the Hoover Dam and you have, you know, different names. Yeah, it's called the cofferdam. But a cofferdam is actually, it's an enclosure built within a body of water to allow the enclosed area to be pumped out or drained. Okay, this pumping creates a dry working environment so that the work can be carried out safely. Cofferdams are commonly used for construction or repair of permanent dams, oil platforms, bridge piers built within water. They're usually welded steel structures with components consisting of sheet piles, cross braces. Such structures are usually dismantled after the construction work is completed. And the origin of it comes from the word coffer, which is Latin for basically a basket, and dam, which is a barrier across a stream of water to obstruct its flow and raise its level. So it's basically a man-made temporary dam that you just hold the water in order to create like a real dam.
Well, I assume that that's what gets broken later on, but I'm not in that week of discussion.
that is what it is, but it's, you know, like I said, I always thought that it was the name of the dam. And if, I mean, I know that you, I know I forgot to send you a copy of the transcript, but the transcript actually has it listed as coffer and then dam, two different words. But a cofferdam is one word. So, you know, I guess whoever did the subtitles, you know, got that one wrong. So. So, I mean, it's nice the way that they play this out for us and explain how things are going. Because I mean, he points on the map and shows us on the map of how the thing is. And did you notice what it says on the map when he says the cofferdam?
I don't remember.
It's written in red ink. It says temporary dam.
Okay.
So they've already explained to us what a cofferdam is. Temporary dam.
So the foreman would use the vernacular that is typical for the construction project, and they're going to give us an interpretation there, basically a dictionary definition for all of us stupid people who are watching the scene play out.
Exactly. But hey, why not? It works. I like the way that they do that. You know, because again, if you're paying attention, then you can see that he's already telling them, you know, the translation of what a cofferdam is. You know, but if you're not, then you just say, okay, they're at the cofferdam. So, and then we get the final line of this minute where John turns to Zeus and he says, all right, I'm going to meet you right there. So the back to what we were talking about with the phone. So at this point, we actually see that it's not a cell phone that John picked up. He's actually picking up a regular phone. It just looked like a cell phone the way that he picked it up at the beginning. So apparently they have a phone line there that he's using. You know, he's not making any call at this point, at least, because, you know, he picks up the phone and then hangs it up. And then, then he turns to Zeus and, you know, tells him that he's going to meet him right there and points on the map to where he's going to meet him, which is something I never paid attention to, because later in the movie, he actually does meet him in that spot. Again, it doesn't make as much sense as one would think, but okay. You know, because the way that John meets Zeus has always baffled me about the coincidence, you know, that they're in the exact same spot. But if that is where Zeus was supposed to meet him, so that sort of makes a little more sense. But we'll get there in a few weeks, and we'll see how that works. All right, did you have anything else you want to say about this minute, Richard?
I did not.
All right, so the script. So if you continue with the script, so you have McLean then says, Simon's using the aqueduct to get off the island. Then he turns to the driver. Can you follow the aqueduct above ground? He goes straight up the Saltwell Parkway. Every quarter mile, there's a ventilation grate. Can't miss him. McLean hands Zeus the slip of paper on which he recorded the card catalog number. So in the script, they don't have to go to Yankee Stadium. They have to go to the New York Public Library, which is, which obviously we can now see the difference here. But again, there isn't that much from this minute that is in the script. So, you know, and tomorrow we'll continue with that about with John giving his orders as to where he wants to go. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Jesus Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five Samuel L. Jackson performances. So Richard, once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Well, you know, number five, I'm sick and tired of these mother effing snakes on this mother effing plane. That's the one that I've got in number five, because that's just too much fun, that movie. And Samuel L. Jackson leans into the ridiculousness of the premise. And I like the fact that he made the movie because of the script title. And when they tried to change the title of the movie, he bitched about it and said, no, we made Snakes on a Plane, not Pacific Air 123. This is Snakes on a Plane. Let's do that. So even if the performance isn't great, his attitude about the movie is great. Number four
You do know that you are the very first person to use that movie on this list.
Oh, good. Well, there you go. We're checking off an important one then.
There you go.
Number four, I've got Jackie Brown. Ordell is one of the most loathsome criminals that you can find. He's just miserable, and this is a great movie. It's Tarantino doing Elmore Leonard with Pam Grier, and Samuel Jackson's not the lead, but he is the lead villain in the story, and he plays it for all it's worth. I think it's a very good performance. Here's one that I bet might be the first one that you get also. Kingsman, The Secret Service.
Nope, no one's mentioned. Sorry, it was mentioned once.
Once by somebody else. Well, I love the fact that Samuel Jackson basically delivers his whole performance with a lisp. It's funny. It's a parody of the super elite that are trying to fix all the world's problems with their own climate change agenda. And he's the bad guy again. He's a good bad guy. Number two is Resurrecting the Champ. Anybody have that one?
Nope.
Okay. Well, I think this may be his best performance. He plays a homeless guy who is strung out, and we believe he's a former champion boxer, and there's a character who's looking for redemption in covering this story. There are a couple of twists in the story along the way, but Jackson basically does a good job portraying somebody who is may or may not be suffering from the kinds of damage that gets done during a boxing match or a football game, and is struggling with their life at this point in being homeless. I don't want to give too much away, but I think it's a very good performance. And then at number one, I'm sure hundreds of people of your guests, okay, maybe you don't have hundreds of guests, but dozens of your guests have mentioned Pulp Fiction.
You're guest number 16. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. So I think it's pretty obvious. It's his Academy Award nominated performance. It's the one that certainly separated him from other character actors and elevated him to, I think, a higher tier. So it's a good performance.
Yes, you are among there are four people who haven't listed it, including Jay.
Yeah. Well, that's weird.
Well, we know Jay likes to throw.
Well, he had his number one.
No, you don't.
But okay. He didn't have Deep Blue Sea number one.
Not his number one. No. It was his number two. Number two. Number one, Jay went with The Incredibles.
Okay. Well, I would never dismiss the significance of animated vocal performances. I think they are obviously important. But because it's an animated movie and so much of the acting is created in the drawings themselves, it just feels a little bit of a cheat to do that. But that's okay. You know, Jay's a notorious cheater.
Richard, don't start fights. Don't start fights. All right. So, Richard, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Richard Kirkham before Jay comes over there and gets upset at you?
Well, I can't get too upset with Jay because I took over from him as host and shepherd of the Lamb and the Lambcast. He's entrusted me with that, and I've been happy to do that for the last few years. The Lambcast is the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs. You can find it at largeassmovieblogs.com. We have a weekly podcast featuring members of the Lamb community talking about all kinds of movies. For all kinds of reasons. We've got theme shows, current films being discussed. It's a lot of fun. Everybody come and join us because it's usually an interesting talk. On my own site, Kirkham A Movie A Day, it's easy to find just by typing in my name. The slogan on my site is very simple. If I saw it in a theater, you'll read about it here. So I try to do a post on every movie that I see in a theater, and I go to the movies a lot, so there's always something new and fresh there.
All right, and while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe. Many podcasts you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout. The ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.